Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Well, we're looking at life in central and eastern Kentucky in a pandemic, beginning with that thing we need most to get us safely out of this terribly complex, complicated, worrisome situation, education. Our colleges and universities had to make an almost overnight switch to online instruction.
We're going to continue to do that throughout the summer. Many campuses are offering even discounts for graduate programs just simply because we don't want to lose that academic process for those students, especially teachers, this summer.
That's Dr. Aaron Thompson, president of the Kentucky Council on Postsecondary Education.
Now, this fall, I mean, we have different kinds of campuses. I mean, University of Kentucky, which is a high residential campus, versus Southeast Community College, which is a smaller commuter campus. All of us are planning to have face-to-face classes this fall. Now, Tom, just to tell you, it may look different than it did this past spring. It may be more of a hybrid approach. It may be, in some cases, you may have 5-10 people in a class, and then piping that out, that same class, to another 100 people in the residence halls and at home and in other places. But we are planning to restart face-to-face this fall, even at the regular time currently. Now, anything could change. You know, if something happens that we take a reversal on our improvement here on COVID-19, then we will look at that. But as of right now, we're planning to be fully open this fall with face-to-face.
Yes, and I think we should underscore that this is a very fluid situation, and nobody is holding your feet or the feet of our universities to the fire, because we don't know. We don't know if we're going to have another surge or not. So that's where we are. What are you hearing about the transition to online learning?
As a matter of fact, I have some advisory groups that are talking to me about the transition, and I think you do have a mixed bag. I mean, I think campuses that have had a lot of online classes for a long time tended to move smoother into that transition, even though they still had to skill up a lot of people. And I want to give all of our campuses credit, because in like that 2 weeks in March we took to really make sure that everybody had their tools to get online going. Now, I'm sure they were of different quality, no doubt about it, right? If it was already been done online, it was probably different than somehow converting a face-to-face to online in a week. So what I'm hearing is that some students really liked it. Some students can't wait to get back face-to-face. They are just done with it. I'm hearing also that many people, as this national survey showed, may like the hybrid approach a lot. I mean, it gives them some flexibility even. So what I do know, it sounds like those in the residential setting are wanting to come back. In some cases, they may not want to, and I would just urge them to continue online somewhere, hopefully in our state, if they decide they don't want to be going back to the face-to-face setting. But as of right now, I think our campuses have done an excellent job, and they will continue to do this summer, getting faculty skilled up and staff skilled up to provide support as well as a classroom endeavor.
At this stage, are there any indications of impact on enrollment?
You know, I'm talking to the presidents again today. Most of them are saying that they are seeing a fairly steady set of predictors saying that we're staying on track to have a decent class. Now, the problem is, Tom, those predictors aren't necessarily the same ones we used a year ago. Things have changed. So, you know, nationally, they're predicting anywhere between a 10 to 20% decrease. Our FAFSA rates are down, as you all know, in this state, about 5 percentage points, and that's not a good indicator. So we're trying to get that up as we speak. But my guess is that we may come in a little short, but I have to tell you, I'm wary of any sort of predictive variables because, you know, I like trend analysis. We have none. First time we've dealt with this.
Do you anticipate any kind of shift among at least some students from the four-year institutions to community colleges?
I mean, I think that's a possibility, surely. And I will tell those students, go somewhere. If you don't feel like traveling back to a residential setting, want to stay at home, at least try to take classes from that four-year institution online or go to a community college. I know nationally there is looking as if there will be a shift to the community college. Maybe not a huge shift, but some. Without a doubt, we want to keep them in Kentucky. We have a great transfer system in Kentucky. So we feel good about that if that happens. And our KCTCS system is a strong system. So they know what they're doing. But my argument to any student is higher education matters. So stay engaged somehow, even if it's online. That gap year that people talk about really, you know, it may apply to a few people, but not to most people. So the idea that if you need to shift and go to your campus, then fine. That's great. If you want to get reengaged in a four-year system after that, we can make that happen. But at least stay in school. But nationally, there looks like there's going to be a shift toward that. In Kentucky, I wouldn't think we'd be too far off from that national percentage.
And quickly, Dr. Thompson, do you expect that this pandemic, once it's all said and done, will have caused some changes that are likely permanent?
Without a doubt. I mean, you can't have something this big, and, you know, I'm a sociologist. You can't have a cultural change this rapid, this big, without having a longer effect on culture. It's going to happen. Now, what it means, I think, we still don't know. What I do know is that we have to take it and make it innovative. And that's what we do in higher education. We are going to have to look at and evaluate what's been good about this, what we can make better, and then truly be able to put it into a system of innovation. So, yes, I do believe that's the case. I believe that we are going to see far more digital learning in a variety of ways. We're going to see far more digital student support, wraparound services, mental health support, which I'm pushing, as you know. I mean, so I do believe that we're going to be looking at a different way of thinking about it. My guess is that we will not ever go back to the way we looked in December. Now, I don't necessarily think that's bad. I think what it means is that we will adjust and adapt and make the best of what we have. But my argument is we have to do better than that. We have to make it bigger and better and more innovative.
Dr. Aaron Thompson, president of the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education. Thanks so much, Dr. Thompson.
Thank you, Tom.
John Davis is assistant professor of history at Hopkinsville Community College, and he has studied Russia extensively, and he's the author of Russia in the Time of Cholera, Disease Under Romanovs and Soviets. And we invited Dr. Davis to join us to bring some historical context to the coronavirus pandemic that we're now all enduring. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Davis.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
And first, I keep hearing from people that at least they're finding that they finally have some time to do some serious reading. And so I'd like to suggest your book, if I may, which packs a whole lot of history into 310 pages. Where can that be found?
That can be found on the website of the publisher, I.B. Taurus, which has recently been brought out by Bloomsbury, the same folks that bring you the Harry Potter series. So if you're a Harry Potter fan, you're on the right website. Just look for Russia in the Time of Cholera and you'll find it.
Okay. So you have studied the impacts of, I think, something like six pandemics that span the 19th century and the early part of the 20th. So first, how does what we're experiencing now, today, how does it compare?
Well, there's a lot of parallels, Tom. It compares in that people are a little bit bewildered by the unexpected. Cholera was a disease a lot like the COVID-19 that just terrified people. It's a bacteria, and COVID-19 is a virus. But cholera had horrible symptoms, and people were just scared of it. And people were in denial, like they are today. They're maybe underestimating the seriousness of it, that it can't affect me. When it came into any area, folks thought, well, that only affects, you know, the other. That's not going to affect me. You know, I go to church regularly. I pray, this sort of thing. But as, of course, as we know, both of them do not discriminate on based upon ethnicity, religion, or whatever. If you're poor and you're under healthy, it may have more of an effect on you. We see that the COVID-19 gets us older people a little more than the younger people, but younger people get it too. So I think the fear factor and the ideas of whether we should be a closed society or an open society right now, as far as being able to restrict our movements or to be able to go around, which we're very used to. And the same thing in Russia. They're used to going around and doing what they want, and getting stopped for that or being prohibited from that is an issue with a lot of people right now.
Well, I know that you've identified something striking about these pandemics and epidemics that's really interesting, and that's that they typically come in waves, in waves of three.
That's correct, Tom. The great pandemics, the plague, the cholera, and the flu all come in threes, although the earlier ones were far more spread out, but they've recently condensed. You had the Justinian plague from about 541 to 750 CE in the common era, and they've all been in a common era. So that's about three centuries. You have the Black Plague, and the second one is always the most deadly. The Black Plague in 1347 hung around until about 1700, a little after, in the 18th century. And then cholera, which has been with us since about 1817, hit the United States in three waves. The second was the most violent of all of those. So you had the Black Plague, which was the most which was the second wave, which was the most destructive. You have cholera, the second wave, the 1847 to 49 pandemic was the most destructive. The flu, this is what epidemiologists are telling us, that the second wave is going to be worse. And it was with the flu. And this is, they're basing this on history, and there's a lot of basis in fact here, particularly with the flu, which is it only lasted a couple years, but was particularly virulent and deadly. 50 million people worldwide died. The second wave was the most deadly. So this is what our epidemiologists are warning us about.
And that's at a time when we're doing what we can to reopen, to get back to some semblance of normalcy. But I take it that from a historical context, that doesn't appear to be wise.
I think that's exactly right, Tom. I'm not an epidemiologist, but now is the time we need to be listening to our epidemiologist. You use the word normalcy. That's an interesting word. It's a good word to use, because these are not normal times at all. The times are very urgent, and this is times when we need to tighten our belt a little bit, I think. Don't listen to me. I would say listen to our epidemiologist like Dr. Fauci, who is saying sometimes to his detriment the truth that, yeah, we need to be tightening our belts a bit.
Okay, well, here's a question I think we can listen to you about, and that is get your take on important differences between the coronavirus pandemic that we're now enduring and those that occurred in Russia.
Well, those that occurred in Russia, the mode of death was, as I said, was very deadly and very scary. Cholera basically just sucks the water out of you in every way it can suck the water out of you. Your eyes sink back in your head. You have spasms. It's a horrible way to die. It's about a 5 to 7 day incubation period, similar to the coronavirus, in which you could spread it. The coronavirus is a little bit less than that, I think, something like 3 to 5. But the difference is, of course, it was a bacteria. Cholera was a bacteria, and a bacteria generally does not have the ability to spread like this COVID-19. We've already had 1,342 cases. So this is half of the cases that Russians experienced over 100 years in the 19th century and early 20th century. The cases are very high. On the other hand, the mortality is far lower. And that sounds like a good thing, and I guess in some ways it is, but in some ways it's not, because it has the ability to find host and survive. So if this thing is, you know, ever going to die out, it needs not to find host. And part of that hopefully will come through efforts at vaccination and this sort of thing, which we had with cholera. But it was very difficult to find a vaccination with cholera. In fact, I just saw where authorities are just now beginning to espouse in the United States cholera vaccinations if you go outside of the country. They didn't do that when I went to Russia in 2008. So there's a lot of similarities, a lot of differences. Cholera, I think you had more stringent quarantine. And when it hit, it was absolutely terrifying.
Well, Russia has been very slow to acknowledge the extent of its own coronavirus outbreak. Is there historical precedence for that behavior?
Yes, absolutely, Tom. This is kind of how Russia traditionally has approached these sorts of things. If you think of Chernobyl in 1986, when the government said, no. Oh, yeah, we did have a little accident down there in the Ukraine. But this is not just a Soviet thing. This goes way back. They pretty much they don't react fast, and they deny a couple times they had deaths in Astrakhan in southern Russia, and they did not acknowledge it. And this is in the New York Times, by the way, that they were not acknowledging this disease. So, yes, Russia takes a very loose approach. Part of this is not entirely wrong. This is 1/6 of the world's land surface. And the bottom line is they just don't know what to do. You know, setting up a quarantine in 1/6 of the world's land surface is not very easy. So they really are trying to figure out and get their bearings and do what they're going to do. But secrecy is a way of life that goes way back before the Soviets over there. And, of course, you have Mr. Putin, who comes from the KGB. That may not help. But absolutely, in just about every pandemic, there was the tendency to deny.
What would you say are some important lessons from these Russian experiences that we might apply to our present circumstances?
Well, absolutely, you need open communications in government, and you need to listen to your authorities. The reason the cholera pandemics died out in Russia was because Lenin, who we think of as a pretty bad guy, but he was smart enough to listen to his doctors. And he had a fantastic doctor, a fellow by the name of Lev A. Tarasevich, who was kind of the Dr. Fauci of the time, internationally respected, was cooperating with the League of Nations epidemiological section, which was the forerunner of the World Health Organization. They were working together, and this guy understood what was going on. He'd been an epidemiologist at that point for something like 40 years and just had a way of putting it the way it was. He was the Dr. Fauci of that time, and they listened to him, and it disappeared very quickly.
So the lesson is pay attention to the scientist, right?
Pay attention to the scientist and have open communications, even the ones that are telling you what you don't want to listen to. You know, these are the guys that you want to listen to because they're telling you the truth.
Dr. John Davis, he is Assistant Professor of History at Hopkinsville Community College, and we appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
We're debuting a new feature on Eastern Standard. We're calling it Future Tense. Hosted by anthropologist and author Chris Begley, the focus is on our future in a post-pandemic world.
Today I'm talking with Bianca Spriggs, an award-winning poet from Kentucky, currently an assistant professor of English at Ohio University. Her forthcoming book of poems is titled We're Still Big Banging, and will be out in 2021 with Shadeland House Modern Press. You can learn more about her other work at www.biancals.com. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. So let's start by talking about where we are now in the middle of this pandemic. I wanted to ask you, beyond the obvious, what's changed?
For me, it's been observing people collectively working through kind of like the five stages of grief, you know, and it's very clear who has led maybe a little more of a carefree life and people who've sustained trauma before, and watching the patterns of folks who are immediately like, make the bad feelings go away, make it all go away. And then the folks who've been in therapy or have dealt with their demons from trauma before, you know, they're handling this very much aware of their triggers and coping mechanisms. And I find that those people are the ones who are employing strategies to stay afloat emotionally. So for me, it's been very interesting to watch the emotional development, you know, people's EQ sort of evolve on the spot, because, you know, our emotions point to our boundaries. And there are some things that folks clearly haven't dealt with in terms of, you know, acknowledging that control is an illusion, you know, and there are people who've made peace with that and people who haven't. So that's been the most sort of fascinating part of it for me.
What are some of those triggers or boundaries?
Well, I mean, being told no, you can't have something, you know, you can't do something, you can't go somewhere. Folks who haven't heard no very often in their lives are sort of reverting, you know, in a very childish manner to reclaim some aspect of control. For people who've been, you know, for one, culturally and systemically oppressed their entire lives, you know, it's sort of like, okay, there's just another added dimension to this now, you know, unless we're being called in as an essential worker to go work for these people who are protesting in the streets because they want haircuts, you know. So I think that it has been interesting to watch some people start to take ownership of their psychological boundaries. They're acknowledging increasingly, listen, I'm having a bad quarantine day. I'm having a day today. And other people are becoming more respectful of that, of those boundaries, because they can empathize now and say, no, I get it. You know, it comes in waves. So how we're all sort of navigating, you know, those restrictions is, I mean, there's a myriad of ways. Some people are baking. Some people are working out in the yard. Some people like me are writing, or, you know, we all have our little hacks, and those are sort of surfacing right now.
Yeah. And of course, the difference between your situation now and before varies from person to person. You know, for instance, I'm in the house with my wife and three kids, and that was, you know, pretty much the default state before. So, you know, while things have changed, obviously there's some continuity there. For other people, it would be radically different.
Oh, definitely. I'm similar to you. I actually live by myself with two cats. So when people are asked, how you holding up? It's like, well, I wipe my groceries down now, you know, when they get delivered, not much has changed. But for people who were like ships passing the night with their spouses or children, I know, because you and I both work in universities, grown kids coming home all of a sudden and having parents who are like, oh my God, like, what are you, creature? You know, people having to adapt to being confined in close quarters with folks, you know, it's probably feeling a little bit more cloistered than for others.
Well, let's talk about the future there. And I wanted to start with some of the work you've done that has a dystopian or apocalyptic theme. Can you tell me about a short story you wrote, The Adventures of Snow Black?
Sure. I wrote this story actually about a year ago. It was a name. I gave myself this name, Snow Black, because I'm getting to know nature very well. I live in rural Ohio now and have been for the last, you know, 2.5 years. And for me, this story was about intellectual foraging, but I'm very interested creatively and scholarly in terms of, you know, post-apocalyptic narratives. You know, we've talked about that before, but I'm here on my own with no family or networks or community that I'm used to relying on for stimulation. And so I've had to reboot my imagination and decide what I can live off of, what I can make new, and what I can do on my own without the collaborations and partnerships that I've become accustomed to. So this short story is a way of me intertwining, getting to know the flora and fauna around here in Appalachia that just shows up in your yard, you know, and introduces itself, and setting up these kind of boundaries between their space and my space, you know, and also becoming incredibly acquainted with solitude here in ways that I have never been before. It's kind of lonely at first, and now it's like, oh my God, I can hear myself think for the first time. So what folks are experiencing now, I've had a 2-year head start. So that was the premise of the story.
Could you read us a little bit of that?
Sure. I'll read you the first few paragraphs here, and it begins, the character's name is Corinne, and she's journaling her stay here in this sort of nondescript place, and her first entry starts with day 477. She writes, "Remember, no one's coming for you. You have to do these things on your own. No one's coming for you. No one's coming." Corinne remembered the first day she wrote it. She'd tripped and gotten herself stuck while foraging between a boulder and what was left of a basement for 2 days. When she finally managed to get out, her voice ragged from crying for help, covered in the ash and soot that constantly fell. When she finally wiggled her way out and limped back, having sacrificed some of her clothing and her pack, she didn't wipe any of the grime off. She didn't go for the peanut butter powder. She didn't even take a sip of water. She went straight to her little diary by her sleeping bag and took the pen, back then it was a pen, and wrote in big blocky letters, "Day 335, no one is coming for you." And she wrote it every day since, and it kept her alive.
You know, now, of course, you wrote this before all of this started. Now you're living through a situation which will have some similarities, at least to the solitude. Are there some themes from that that you would pull out as highlights or indicative of your experience now?
Yeah, I've been starting this little series called The Quarantine Diaries on Facebook, which are just really these funny little anecdotes, and sometimes they're sad observations or experiences I have with social distancing and also trying to keep my mind occupied and making up these little stories about the groundhog out back and, you know, but also not able to interact with the neighborhood girl down the street when she got a new puppy. I can't get close to her and just, you know, and I know her, you know what I mean? So it's weird, and having a little kid look at you kind of scared all of a sudden, like I'm not supposed to interact with this woman because she doesn't live in my house. You know, seeing that realization dawn on a kid's face is, you know, so chronicling those little moments and encounters has become a way for me to just kind of stay sane, like this is actually happening, because memory will make it fuzzy one day.
Yeah, that's certainly something I've noticed. These interactions are now, you know, fraught with peril in ways that they weren't before. And so your interaction with people is different. And, you know, that brings me to the last thing I wanted to ask you about, which is a vision for the future. You know, when I study how people and how societies have changed in the past, one of the things that comes up over and over again is this amazing resilience in the face of, you know, sometimes true catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And thinking about our future after this, what is your vision of that?
Oh, that's so interesting. Maybe tangentially related to your observation, I'm hoping that this sort of competitiveness that Americans are so prone to, kind of like colonialist mindset we've all inherited, that pull yourself up by your bootstraps and there is shame in asking for help and there's something wrong with you if you don't have something to show for yourself. I'm really hoping that we're done with that. We're done with that era, that it's okay to help one another. It's okay to ask for help. The new industries that are going to arise from this, some things will be salvaged, but they'll look different. The new career paths, the new options people will have for keeping themselves busy, for connecting with community. I'm hoping it will be with more dignity and respect for everybody's experience increasingly moving forward, because now we really are in this together, you know?
Yeah.
So that's my hope.
I share that hope. And I want to thank you for helping me by being my very first guest here on Future Tense.
Thank you. I'm honored. I appreciate it.
WEKU is now providing a daily 10-minute coronavirus update hosted by Kelly McEvers. NPR's Coronavirus Daily podcast is available at weku.org. Look for the blue coronavirus link and click the Listen Now tab to hear the latest. Coming up after the break, how racism influenced the shaping of the 19th Amendment extending voting rights to women.
People actually said that if we don't suppress the right to vote or the voting opportunities for black people, particularly black men, then black men will come in and enact all these laws and put white women and white children at risk.
University of Kentucky professor of American and African American history Nikki Brown is interviewed by UK history professor Kathy Kern for the latest in our series on ratification of the 19th Amendment 100 years ago. Plus, how the pandemic has upended things at the Appalachian Center for the Arts in Pikeville. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We have the latest in our monthly series on the 19th Amendment, which established women's right to vote 100 years ago. Here's series host, University of Kentucky history professor Kathy Kern.
My guest today is Dr. Nikki Brown, associate professor of history and African American and Africana studies at the University of Kentucky. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. Dr. Kern, how are you?
Dr. Brown, good to hear your voice. We are thinking about the history of the 19th Amendment. It's the centennial year of the 19th Amendment. And I'm reminded that your first book dealt with Black women's activism from World War I, so a little bit before the 19th Amendment, to the New Deal.
Right.
And in this year of the centennial of the 19th Amendment, what do we need to understand about how the extension of voting rights in 1920 included or excluded Black women?
I think that voting rights in 1920 and the work that Black women did to secure voting rights in the 1920s really hasn't changed much in the last century. So that much of the work that Black women do now in terms of working on securing voting rights and ending voter suppression, that work also took place in the 1910s and 1920s, although it was a different form or a different shape, but it was still it still addressed many of the same issues, and I think that that's something that is quite sobering for historians of political science and political activism.
It also gives us a sense of a usable past, that you're saying that there are connections between Black women's activism around the 19th Amendment and our contemporary controversies over voter suppression?
Yes, yes. One of the enduring problems that comes in the voting rights activism business is tackling the issue of fear and particularly of a Black menace. Now, in the 1920s, the fear of a Black, sort of a horde of Black people coming in and taking over the voter rolls, that was well documented. And people actually said this. People actually said that if we don't suppress the right to vote or the voting opportunities for Black people, particularly Black men, then Black men will come in and enact all these laws and put white women and white children at risk. Now, we don't use those phrases anymore in the last 20 years or so, although as an asterisk, Lee Atwater hinted at this when he was talking about his Southern strategy. Still, in 2016 and 2018, we don't use phrases like there's going to be a Black horde or a Black menace that is going to take away white people's rights. Instead, they use other forms of coded language. And the other form of coded language that's often used is this idea of criminality. Again, it's the same fear of a unknown menace or a group of criminals who are coming in and changing the laws so that the laws will help the criminals commit even more crimes and leave people unprotected. And so the work that Black women did in the 1920s really addressed that head on and said, this is racist language and we're not going to engage in this. Now, in 2018 and 2020, perhaps the intent is still there, but the language has changed.
Well, your point, I think, is that this is part of our history that's uncomfortable to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's that white suffragists were not, and the suffrage movement was not incidentally racist, but rather woman suffrage and the extension of voting rights to one group was a way to protect white supremacy.
Yeah. Again, in the 1920s, sometimes the language that was used wasn't particularly explicit, although I'm looking here and I found that women like Alice Paul, who was portrayed as a mere living saint in the movies Iron-Jawed Angels, for the way that she protested on behalf of women, she was very clear in the 1920s that when she was going around the country, she was telling groups of white women suffragists that she was going to work against black women voting, that black women should not vote, and that when the right to vote would be secured for women, she would make sure that black women were excluded from those rights. And at the same time, even though Alice Paul and Susan B. Anthony or Carrie Chapman Catt of the National American Women's Suffrage Association, even though those two organizations are often pitted against each other, even NAFA, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, and its president, Anna Howard Shaw, said that white women had a particular responsibility to vote so that they could protect their families and their children against black men, and that it was unfair that black men had superiority or had a voice, a political voice, over white women, and that this is one thing that white women could do to make the racial scales equal in her mind. So she pitched it as it being unfair for someone who is socially, physically, mentally inferior to have any type of dominion over someone that was at that time regarded to be socially and mentally and physically superior. So that's also how they pitched this idea as a way to even the scales.
Right. So that's an argument that emerges in Reconstruction and mm-hmm. even in some ways in the abolition movement and then continues through the 19 teens and 20s, this idea that it's not fair that some people are getting the right to vote and others who might perceive themselves to be intellectually superior are
right.
held without the vote. Yeah. And you make another interesting point there that the controversies, there are all these controversies that we're aware of and that have been popularized in movies like Iron-Jawed Angels, that the controversies between the generations of women suffragists, that those have been played up, and yet most of these white women are united around this idea of white supremacy.
Yeah, although I would say this, that whiteness is still, in the 1920s, such a fluid concept that when we talk about white supremacy now, the way that they would understand it would be white Anglo-Saxon Protestant women, middle-class women, women who didn't work, mm-hmm. women who went to church, women who are married, women who had kids, and women who were supported fully by their husbands, women who weren't the equal of their husbands, but women who were sort of the helpmate of their husbands. And so in terms of whiteness, even this definition of whiteness is leaving what we would consider other white women out. It wasn't talking about Irish women. It wasn't talking about Catholic women. It wasn't talking about rural women from Appalachia. No. This very narrow definition of who deserved the right to vote and who was going to be protected by the right to vote really applied to also a narrow slice of the American population. But one of the things that's really interesting is that they left that part out. They didn't say, well, you know, we as middle-class white women want the right to vote, and we're not sure that rural women or poor women or Irish women would have that same right. So they didn't say that. What they said was, we as upstanding citizens need to be protected, and there's a black menace out there that's trying to take what's ours, and we need to protect what is our rightful claim by making sure that
angry Black women and ignorant Black men aren't put in a position of power over us.
Well, there's also at the same time this evolving concept of race suicide that's all about whiteness, right? That we have so many immigrants who had come to the United States at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, and we see emancipation of African Americans, and there's this fear on the part of white people that that whiteness is slipping away, that the white race is actually embattled. That it's under attack in some way. And we even see that emerge in conversations about Appalachia and the interest in Appalachia in the early 20th century as a place where you could still tap into a pure white race who had been supposedly untouched by the industrial world, which was, of course, a myth. But it resonates with what you're saying, that the right to vote would be a way to protect the deserving among white people.
Yes, exactly. And it's strange because even that definition, not your definition, but the understanding of what Appalachia is, of course, African Americans live in Appalachia. But again, for many suffragists, that wasn't important. It was that all African Americans are being painted with the same inferior brush. And the idea is that these pure white groups have to bind, have to come together and keep this Black menace from organizing. So in my writing, I also wanted to talk about the response to that, that Black women understood that these were particular challenges facing them, and that they went ahead and organized anyway, that they really did the best with what they were given. And so Black women activists in the 1920s are going to say things like, your vote is necessary so that you can decide what type of schools your kids can go to, or your vote is necessary so that you can make sure that Black teachers are paid the same amount as white teachers, and your vote is necessary so that you can change these segregation laws and demand more justice. And in one case, Black suffragists said, your vote is necessary because it's a part of being a good citizen. It's a vital part of being a good citizen. And so I think it's important not to let the story end on white supremacy or its attempts to deny Black people the vote. I think the story continues to be interesting when we look at what Black women did to navigate a lot of the limitations that white supremacist politics tried to put in their way. And so, for example, a good example of that would be that for many, many decades, Black women accepted that a poll tax was in place. And instead of working to overcome the poll tax, because they knew that many states would never give up the poll tax, they just encouraged people to pay the poll tax. And they took up donations and collections so that men and women could pay the poll tax and go in and vote anyway. So they're trying to navigate these structures.
That's such a great example, because it also shows that the right to vote, it's not just an abstract principle, but these women saw the need for the vote to change local conditions and to change their local political context.
Right. It wasn't always successful. But so what? So what if it's not successful? I mean, the attempts are there, and the attempts are going to build up so that maybe one attempt is going to fail, but 10 failed attempts is going to equal one success. And that, I think, is the idea that many Black women activists are operating under. They're going to keep challenging these laws. They're going to keep trying to register. They're going to keep focusing on how unfair and how difficult it is to register to vote in places like Alabama and Georgia. And they're going to keep pushing this. And they're not going to just stop at getting the right to vote. They're going to keep making sure that states that put up these roadblocks are constantly monitored so that more generations can vote. And in the case of Stacey Abrams, she isn't so much focusing on voting rights. She's focused on voter suppression and overcoming the newest generation of roadblocks that keep poor people, people of color, and working class people, that keep them from voting as well.
Well, and also, you know, your focus on this of like, let's not stop the story in 1920, but let's look at all the activism that Black women enacted to try to get that right to vote in their communities. That gives us a way to kind of have both things, to still celebrate the 19th Amendment as a stepping stone, but to focus our energies on understanding that little known history of what Black women did after the 19th Amendment.
Yes, absolutely. The work that Black women did is clear-eyed. They understand that there is an incredible opposition to granting Black people the right to vote, but they're not going to stop. And they are trying to be as thorough as they can and as persistent as they can so that voting rights is still recognized. And I think so there's a direct through line from someone like Alice Dunbar Nelson or Mary Church Terrell in the 1920s to Fannie Lou Hamer in the 1960s to Stacey Abrams now. There's a direct line connecting all of these women in terms of their activism.
Dr. Brown, that's a great point to make. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and for being our guest on this show. Dr. Nikki Brown, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Robin Irwin was in the Tony Award-winning production of Titanic on Broadway. Eric Buckley played Uncle Fester in the Broadway production of The Addams Family. Today, this husband and wife team lives in Pikeville, Kentucky, where together they operate the Appalachian Center for the Arts. Greetings, Robin and Eric, and let me first ask you, if you would, tell us what brought you to Pikeville, Kentucky.
Well, we came down here because we wanted a different way of life, a better more quality of life.
So the Appalachian Center for the Arts has been open for a year now.
A year, yes.
And there's a pandemic. So what's what's happened?
Gosh darn it. it's unprecedented what we're facing, what all artists are facing, and all live entertainment and cultural gatherings. It's about that communal experience. And when all the authorities say, nope, you can't gather, then what do you do? How do you stay relevant? How do you still be seen as something essential? You know, I could preach till the cows come home about how art is essential to the lifeblood of a community, but this is unprecedented times.
So like every other venue in the country, you've been dealing with cancellations.
Just our organization in the month of March and April, we had a sold-out run of Charlotte's Web for school groups. So that's 8 performances. It all had to be canceled. And it should be. It should be. Hillbilly Days, which is an event, music and entertainment, and a giant fundraiser for the Shriners, where 100,000 people descend on our little town, canceled.
So when an organization like the Center for the Arts goes dark, heaven forbid, but that's what we're dealing with at the moment, the domino effect in the community is quite powerful, isn't it? What can you tell us about the impact on restaurants, hotels, tourism in the Pikeville area?
Well, absolutely. I can speak directly to Hillbilly Days as a perfect example. Some of the hotels here count on Hillbilly Days sort of as their linchpin for their whole year because literally in Hillbilly Days, you have to go 2 counties over to find a hotel room. The hotels for Hillbilly Days have been booked since October. And so that income is gone. All of the restaurants here, some of them set up outdoor booths. I know that there's an organization here that basically plans its entire year based on the income that gets generated by the Hillbilly Days. So when that's gone, everybody sort of scrambles around.
So if social distancing becomes the norm for a long time, you all thinking about that and how you might revise your work to arrange large crowds into clusters of smaller groups? Will you put a cap on audience?
Yes, we've been talking about that. Like, for example, in August, we're supposed to do a dinner theater event because the chef at the arena who provides the food is spectacular. We're like, well, why don't we cut capacity in half and put them at tables and put 4 people at tables, or should we include masks with this? We're listening to authorities and listening to our public health officials and Governor Beshear, and his leadership has been great, and our town leadership and the commission. They're really, everyone is on it. So I think we have good people to make these decisions with collaboratively. But in terms of the programming, we're, you know, we're looking at going online. Lexington Children's Theater, I know, is going online with their summer camps. And so we're probably going to do that. But it's a lot of hurry up and wait. Well, it could be. Well, because if there's another surge, then we're back at square one.
We hear from so many sectors, so many industries, that this could be some sort of inflection point. That,
oh, yes.
Whatever we see happen on the other side of this thing is probably going to be quite different from what the norm is now.
Well, you know, this is really a sticky wicket, and I'm talking, and Eric is talking to all our friends, and everyone's trying to figure out. It's sort of like Singing in the Rain, you know, when they're like, close down the theater. The jazz thing is a hit. And now we all have to learn in more than a cursory way the technology. But audiences are necessary. I can't stress enough that theater is a communal live experience. Yes, live streaming is great. And if you have live streaming capability and everything is archived and you can program it, that's great. And that should be a part of your strategic plan. But I don't think it's going to be the norm. I think in 3 to maybe 18 months, it'll be some semblance of a new normal.
The theater experience is so unique. I mean, there is that organic connection between stage and audience.
Yes.
Is that at risk now, do you think?
Oh, do you want my honest answer?
Yes.
You know, it's the second oldest profession. Live theater goes back to the time of Aristotle when it was codified. I mean, this, the ritual and the communal aspect of the theater, you can't compete with it. That's why it's been around. Even though it is not heralded as such, it's there is theater everywhere. But I do think it's, I don't want to say it's at risk, but it's going to have to change. It's going to have to change.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Robin Irwin, Executive Director, Eric Buckley, Director of Education and Outreach at the Appalachian Center for the Arts in Pikeville. Thank you both for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org. Also on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.